Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
For those listening now, you're probably wondering why I'm talking English. This is our first episode in Wine of the Week where we speak English. And the reason is because we have a special guest today. We have Katie Blakely, who's the International Sales Manager of Ridge Vineyards. So thank you very much, Katie, for coming all the way from California.
Thank you.
I know you're obviously not here only for us. You're doing tastings in town. But for us, it's fantastic for you to spend a little bit of time talking about, obviously, Ridge Wines.
Ridge Wines, yeah. I'm really excited. Thank you both so much for having me. It's an exciting time. This is my first trip back to mainland Europe since the COVID pandemic.
Yeah.
So it's exciting to be out traveling and tasting with people and seeing you in 3D again.
Yeah.
And it's really exciting for us because this is a very celebratory year. This is our 60th anniversary.
Yeah.
So really, this is kind of kicking off all of the excitement and the festivities for the year to come. And we've got a lot of exciting wines to talk about. So
fantastic. Yeah. But I mean, for the people who might not have that in-depth knowledge about Ridge Vineyards,
yeah,
you're saying it's the 60th year.
Yes.
But the history of Ridge goes back even further, right?
It does. So we have right now two visitation properties, two production facilities, Lytton Springs and Montebello. And mm-hmm. these represents two of the three estates of Ridge. So we've got Montebello, which is where everything began. And then we have Lytton Springs and Geyserville. Okay. So when you look at the history of these three vineyard sites, it spans all the way back to the late 1800s. So let's begin with Montebello because that's where our company began 60 years ago.
It's probably the most famous one too, right?
It definitely is. Yeah. And, it's the pilgrimage, if you will.
Yeah.
And we can talk about really why that is, the topography of the vineyard site, because it is a mountain vineyard in every sense of the word, perhaps once we get closer to the estate cab. So the Montebello vineyard is in the Santa Cruz Mountains, which is a very unique AVA within California because
mm-hmm.
it really sits on its own. It's not part of Sonoma or Napa, which is, of course, more known worldwide, and it's not part of the Central Coast. It encapsulates three counties that start about 45 minutes south of San Francisco. So you've got mostly Santa Cruz County, Santa Clara County, and a touch of San Mateo County. Now, while this might not be the first wine region people think of when they think of California, it's one of the most historically rich and robust regions. So let's take Montebello, for example. Our mountain vineyard was actually a very diverse wine growing area back in the late 1800s. So we began with a gentleman named Osea Peroni. He was a very influential doctor in the Italian community in San Francisco back in the late 1800s. And he made the trek all the way down from the city center to our mountain vineyard, up the windy road. And for those of your listeners who have visited Montebello, they know how difficult that is to do currently in a car.
Yeah.
To do it by horse and carriage is borderline bananas.
Why was he doing it? Like to look for a vineyard? Or
For a vineyard site. And he planted Cabernet Sauvignon at the very top of the mountain. And that's where our production began. And if you come and visit or even look at our website, we've got some really fantastic photographs of him and his family in full gear at harvest time.
Yeah.
And he sold wine, brought it back down to San Francisco to have it bottled and transported back to the East Coast. And he was followed very shortly by a gentleman named John Torre, who was a Nevada cattle rancher, but also Italian in heritage. And he came and settled the vineyard site right below Osea and worked basically subsequently alongside him on the mountain. And then we had Pierre Klein, who was an Alsatian who settled the very bottom of the mountain. And his goal was to create an award-winning claret from California.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually would arguably have the most success of the three families. He was more internationally well-known. Now, unfortunately, our country then went on to make one of our biggest mistakes, Prohibition.
Mm-hmm.
And these families, unfortunately, lost the vineyard sites, and they stood for all intents and purposes abandoned.
But were these families kind of independent winemakers, or were they collaborating?
They were not collaborators, to my knowledge. Yeah. From everything that we understand, they were all independent of each other, although I'm sure friendly neighbors.
Yeah.
It's not a very large mountain.
Yeah.
And so then we fast forward to 1948. A gentleman named William Short, he was a theologian, actually purchased what we know as the Torrey property, which included a barn originally built by the Torreys back in the late 1800s. And he planted about 10 acres of Cabernet Sauvignon. And he was there until about 1958 when he decided it was time to leave and sell the property. And that's where the Ridge Founders came in. Hmm. So these three gentlemen were all Stanford graduates and worked at the Stanford Research Institute in Silicon Valley. These three were not winemakers. They were scientists and had not set out with the intent of beginning a commercial winery. They purchased this property as a retirement plan. You know, Montebello overlooks all of Silicon Valley. From our property, you can see the Apple campus, you know, the Google campus, Levi's Stadium, all of that. And so their purpose was to take in the beautiful view, build some individual homes, and retire there with the families. Thankfully, one of them, Mr. Dave Benyon, very inquisitive by nature, knew of the rich winemaking history at the mountain. So he took about a half barrel and made that wine in his garage using very primitive, historic, pre-industrial winemaking techniques. In fact, one of them being just taking a wooden lid, like lattice, putting it on top of crushed grapes, so they submerge the skins underneath the juice so as not to dry out. Mm-hmm. Him and his wife went on vacation and came back, and the wine had fermented dry on the native yeasts present in the grapes themselves. Mm-hmm. And while that sounds, you know, very primitive, very simple, it's not too far removed from how we currently make wine today.
Yeah. And kind of how a lot of winemakers, you know, almost find like a modern way of low-intervention winemaking.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so he did that and was able to convince the other two to create a bonded winery. And so Ridge was born in 1962. And over the next 7 years, they really kind of, you know, were part-time winemakers and trying to piece together this business. And Paul Draper then came back to the U.S. From a stint in Chile in 1969, and he met with these guys. There was a familiarity there. Paul's also a graduate of Stanford, and they knew of the work he was doing down in South America. And so he interviewed with these guys, and one of my favorite Paul Draper moments is a video where he says, "I tasted their 62 and 64 vintages." These guys had no idea what they were doing, and the wines were pretty good. Mm-hmm. "I know exactly what I'm doing. This could be the opportunity to make some of the most world-class wines."
Yeah.
And really, in that moment, it's the emphasis and the highlight on why we focus on single vineyard expressive lots.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's the Ridge way. And really all of the care and consideration into the cultivation of beautiful fruit. And our winemaking team, our viticulturalists, they're stewards of that land and that fruit and kind of guide that into the process of what you see here.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the story, basically.
That's the story. And then, you know, we've done some things since 1969. So,
yeah.
and celebrating our 60th anniversary. So it's very exciting.
I remember the first time I tasted Ridge. It was on a restaurant called Le Canard in Oslo, a Michelin star restaurant.
Okay.
And I got a 1985 vintage with Montebello.
Fantastic.
And it was a moment. Yeah.
Yeah.
But more or less because I thought it was a Bordeaux.
Oh, sure.
Or something else.
Of course.
And then after traveling also there and meet and taste more, it's still one of the icons of California wine industry. So it's very good. And
thank
very nice
much.
To do here. We love it.
Now we have a few wines. We actually have four wines that we're going to taste down the road in this conversation. But since you're celebrating 60 and your history is even longer, right? The theory of low intervention winemaking, pre-industrial winemaking, or I heard someone from Ridge call it just like low tech winemaking.
Sure.
Is that still how has that changed? And is it the same throughout the range of wines now, or what's been going on in the past 60 years?
Though? Sure. And that's a fair question. You know, because our range is quite large.
Yeah.
And I think
how large is it?
Yeah. So outside of the cellar door, you'd never really fully be able to grasp. So we make approximately 35 wines a year. Yeah. And about 14 of them go out to the U.S. wholesale market, and approximately 8 to 9 go out to the international market.
Okay.
And so if you get the opportunity to come down and visit us at either Lytton Springs or Montebello, you get to see some really geeky stuff that we do, which is fantastic. One of the things I love about Ridge is not only the commitment to the historical products like Lytton Springs and Geyserville and Montebello, but still, I mean, we're all wine geeks, right? So there's a fascination about what California has to offer. So most recently, we've started to produce Falanghina. We'll do Grenache Blanc. We've done a Viognier. We've started to dip into Pinot Noir again. And yeah. At the base of really all of that is approximately 20 different Zinfandel expressions.
Hmm. Yeah. But these new grapes.
Yeah.
Is that from existing vineyards where you plant new grapes, or are you buying grapes or buying new vineyards?
We're purchasing the fruit.
Yeah.
So we're working with new vineyard sites from around California, yeah. which is really a historical Ridge practice. We've been doing that since our inception. And so, for example, the Falanghina fruit, we're working with a vineyard site in Mendocino.
Yeah.
Grenache Blanc, we've actually teamed up with the Adelaina Winery down in Paso Robles, which we have a very rich history there as well. One of the longest running wines in our portfolio that's seen in the domestic market is a wine called the Paso Robles Zin from the Benito Ducey Ranch. And so we have a great history there. David Gates, our senior VP of vineyard management, was a president of the Rhone Rangers, which is a very collaborative group down in based in Paso. And so Adelaida were kind enough to allow us to purchase fruit from their Viking vineyard. And that allowed us to do a Grenache Blanc. You know, white wine has never been a very large portion of our production. Mm-hmm. Of course, we've built our reputation on beautiful reds. But they're just as important as exciting. Chardonnay has kind of been the one stalwart, and so it's been nice to add a couple of friends, including the Grenache Blanc.
Are any of these I'm calling it like odd grapes. They're not odd grapes.
No, but no, no,
they're,
no.
But they're very unusual in the sense that, like, we as, you know, maybe international market or Norway know Ridge. Like,
sure.
We're not thinking of Pinot Noir and Viognier when we think yeah. about Ridge. Are these available in international markets at all, or is it this just in the U.S.?
They are just in the U.S., but even furthermore, just in direct to consumer. So in our cellar door.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, an incentive to come to California and visit us in either Santa Cruz or Healdsburg.
But any of them are they going to be available in international? Is it just small quantities and just at the place? Or
yeah,
where's it going?
Yeah, it's going mostly to our wine club members. So we have a very, very, very large wine club based yeah. in the United States, yeah. Approximately 17,000 members.
Yeah.
If our direct-to-consumer VP hears this, he'll probably correct me. It might even be larger at this yeah. point. But, you know, these are small lots. And when we're talking about production, we're talking maybe 500 cases here, 800 cases there. It's not large enough, unfortunately, to bring out to the international market. So it's really that allows us to do that experimentation and do some exciting things. But that, again, it's really the estates – the wines that have created their place in our history that come out to the international market.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, this is maybe off topic, but the thing about these wine clubs, that's become a really big part of how you sell wine in California, right?
Huge.
Like, is that – how much is that growing? Or – because that's been part of the pandemic thing too, right? People aren't moving out. They're not going out to the store.
Yeah.
They buy directly.
Sure.
So, like, how big of your production is wine clubs in the U.S.?
Yeah, wine clubs are a massive part. I mean, they are a multi-billion-dollar-a-year business in the United States.
Yeah.
And Ridge is no exception.
Yeah.
I would say approximately 50% of our total production is direct-to-consumer.
50?
Yeah, 50, yeah.
And when you say direct-to-consumer, that's basically wine clubs?
Basically wine clubs, yeah.
Wow, really? Yeah.
Or sales directly, again, through the cellar door.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's wild, actually.
It's wild, yeah.
Like, I mean, we're strange here in Norway because of the wine monopoly.
Sure.
But that's a really big deal. That's a really big deal.
So for consumers, you know, we have a lot of visitation. You know, visiting and immersing yourself at a property is you know, one of the age-old pastimes in California.
Yeah.
But not only that, a lot of states in the United States have opened up channels to allow shipping of wine from California to be easier. So, you know, you find a winery that you really like. You don't have to really search for it in your local market. You can yeah. just order it direct from the website and, you know, it's easy. And a lot of people through COVID especially got really comfortable with the online platforms.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
But it still is, Rich also have been very, all the wines you are making in the States, they are something who is very special also for us to taste. And when I'm visiting Rich, sure. I taste all of them.
Yeah.
And some of them were quite odd to our taste, because the American, they have some issues with alcohol. They have some issues with
or love for it.
Love for it. But not everything is perfect. But what you have chosen to export is fantastic. But the way in Norway is that Rich have been kind of a marked, who is exclusive. You also, as we have here, not so expensive wines. We have a wine who is costing 489 kroner, and also more expensive.
Yeah.
So still, Rich is a very good buy in Norway because it's very, very powerful in taste, usually.
Mm-hmm.
But before we got in here, we talked about Norway as a market for Ridge.
Sure.
And you say that it's you know, obviously we're a small country, but relatively, actually Norway likes Ridge a lot, or you sell a lot in Norway?
We do. So Norway, you guys are big fans of Ridge, which we appreciate. I appreciate. So, you know, our current importer has done a wonderful job of effectively communicating Ridge and exciting the market here. And so Norway is one of our top 10 markets internationally, and we export to 50 plus countries. And so when you look at a market of that size, Norway is a very important piece of Ridge's overall success.
Yeah.
Cool. And when it comes, you know, you talk about price specifically, and I'm so glad that you brought that up, because unfortunately, I think a reality that you are seeing in California wines is becoming more expensive. You know, labor is expensive. We've gone through a historic drought for the second time with the 20 and 21 vintages, and that's following the drought that hit us 12 through 15. You take into consideration now increasing costs of supply chain logistics and all of that, and you're going to see that unfortunately reflected in the cost of a bottle. But one of the things I admire so much about this brand and the people who lead it is the real caution in raising prices. And then when we do that, we do so very, very slightly, and really only as it is necessary. Because for us, wine is part of our daily life, and we want to make sure that it is the same for our, you know, enthusiasts, you know, all over the place. And when I see us raise prices, typically it's just a couple of dollars a bottle, which is nice to see.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, we have four wines.
Yep.
We have Lyden Springs 2014.
Yep.
This is one that is available in Norway now, right?
So, yes. And it's actually part of a library re-release.
Yeah.
And so there is a small allocation coming back into the market this year. It hopefully, fingers crossed, should land in about November.
Fantastic. Yeah. And then we have the same wine, but in 2011. And it looks like it's a Magnum.
Yep.
It's a moment.
So we can taste them up against each other.
Sure.
And then we have the Lyden Springs Petit Syrah 2018, which you also sell. And then you have the Ridge Estate Cabernet Sauvignon 2019, which I understand is coming this autumn.
It is.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So I'm excited to taste these wines.
Yeah.
And I think let's start from our left-hand side with the Lyden Springs 2014.
Okay.
Why don't you, introduce us and the listeners to, you know, exactly the style of Lyden Springs. Like, what are we tasting?
Sure. So Lyden Springs, as I mentioned very early on, is our second kind of visit location. So we do have a production facility there. And Lyden Springs is the third estate of Ridge. So it's the baby of the trio. We began working with this vineyard in 1972, and it became an official Ridge estate in 1991. So alongside the Geyserville and Montebello, this is probably one of the most well-recognized and popular wines that we make. It is a Zinfandel-based wine. Again, Ridge really celebrates the Zinfandel varietal. But what you see most often with us is they are blends, right? Zinfandel can be so harmonious with other varietals, and that's what you see here with the Lytton. So this is always going to be mostly Zinfandel, backed by a healthy amount of Petit Syrah, then Carignan, and then from certain vintages, there could be just 1%, maybe 2% of Mataro as well. So what you see here is a Zinfandel-based wine from Dry Creek Valley, arguably one of the premier regions in the world for growing Zinfandel successfully. And alongside every wine that we make, the focus here is balance, right? Elegance and pairing ultimately with food. Not to say these wines aren't terribly enjoyable on their own. I've done plenty of research about that myself. But they are really to be enjoyed with company and with courses. And so that's what I think you see here.
And like, what's the traditional Californian food pairing for this wine then?
So what you will hear very often is Zinfandel and barbecue.
Yeah. That's true.
Which is, I mean, spectacular. Mm. So, I mean, that's...
And big barbecues, not small ones.
No, I don't think we do anything small.
No.
Zinfandel and barbecue. But what's great with Litten and Geiserville, again, given the blended nature of both of these wines and the other varietals that they complement, you get such a wide range. I've had Litten Springs paired at dinners with venison. Yeah. I've had it paired in the past with heartier vegetarian dishes based with like portobello mushroom. Mm. They've been very, very successful. So it's great to see the versatility of these wines. And one of the reasons that we are re-releasing the 14, current vintage is 2020, just for comparison's sake. We're re-releasing these wines because we really want to showcase what Zinfandel can do with a bit of age on it.
Yeah.
You know, especially Zinfandel complemented with Petit Sirah Carignan, right? So for a bit of historical context for your listeners, you know, Zinfandel is a varietal that can lend itself quite naturally to high levels of sugar, therefore being a very high-level alcohol grape, if you're not careful, which is why I know you'll see some Zinfandels coming out of California hitting that 16, 16.5 mark, right? What Zinfandel can sometimes lack naturally is some good acid and a structured tannic presence. So what you have, and of course you need the acid and the tannic presence for that development over years, right? So what you have here, the Petit Sirah being obviously a very tannic varietal, and Carignan having a nice tannic presence as well, but some important acidity. Those two varietals kind of act as support beams for the Zinfandel and allow it to develop over years. If you wanted to lay down the Litten for 20 or 25 years, same with Geiserville, you'd have no problem doing so.
Yeah, and I'm surprised. Like I understand that there's not much Petit Sirah or Carignan in this. There's 10% Petit Sirah.
Exactly.
I think it's still quite tannic.
Sure.
And like even after being aged for 8 years or something like that.
Yeah.
It's a lot, and I think. When people usually, because I mean, in Norway we don't have the biggest selection of Zinfandel, right? Like, because it's not usually that made in Europe, and we drink a lot of European wine,
sure,
right?
Sure.
So we don't have that much Zinfandel, and I think it would be really interesting for listeners who haven't necessarily tasted Zinfandel in a style that is mixed with, for example, Petit Sirah, to see how that works, because it is a very different wine.
It is.
So I think, like, on the aroma side, you obviously have some of the classic Zinfandel style in there, but it makes a huge difference with the Petit Sirah.
Absolutely does.
Yeah. And I think, as when you say it's good, like, Zinfandel is good for barbecue.
Yeah.
I mean, I love wines. I love all wines with all food.
Sure.
But I do really appreciate also the wines that have that tannic structure in. So I mean, like the classic Zinfandel barbecue.
Yeah.
I think that's that's good.
Sure.
But it's great. But if it has more structure.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But the Zinfandel grape is, I've tasted a lot. But I think when you have older Zinfandel wines, I mean, then it's better. How old is the wines from the rich Litten?
The vines themselves.
So
Litten Springs is home to some of the oldest vines that we work with as a company. The oldest in the 110 to 120 range.
Yeah.
I would say the average age of the vines is probably sitting around 60 years old.
Yeah.
And the youngest vines we replanted ourselves back in 2007, 2008. Mm. So you get a wide range of vine age.
So if a consumer or listener here is buying a Zinfandel young, it's a completely different world.
It's a very different experience. Mm. In fact, if they'd like to stay in the Ridge family, the 2018 East Bench is currently still out in the market, or 2019, which we've seen at the Monopoly stores currently, that is 100% Zinfandel.
Yeah.
So you get a pure expression of the Zinfandel variety coming from California, also Dry Creek Valley.
Yeah.
And when you talk vine age, it's a very young vineyard. So we planted the East Bench vineyard in 2000 and made our very first vintage in 2006. So you're talking 22-year-old vines.
Yeah.
Now, talking about the age of these wines,
I
am on my deep into the second glass here.
Are you really the 11 already? Okay.
Yeah.
And I was just listening while you were talking about it, and I think the difference between these two wines are surprisingly big, actually.
Yeah.
Because the 14 is, I think on the nose, it's not only the classic Zinfandel aromas,
yeah,
but it's also it's quite fruity and it feels quite young, right? Mm-hmm. Even though it's 80 years old, but the 11 is very different, and it's much harder to grasp on the nose that this could be a Zinfandel.
Yeah.
So and tasting it also, it feels a lot lighter.
Sure.
I'm not sure if I mean, you guys should tell me like how much this has to the specific vintages.
Yeah.
Or how much this is just the aging, because this is really interesting to me to see the huge difference. And I think the 11 is, I would never guess Zinfandel.
Yeah, I would bet that you could put this in front of some of the top wine minds in the world and they wouldn't guess Zinfandel.
Oh, yeah.
It's just, it doesn't drink that way. It's so tricky in that regard. So to your point, I think two things. One, the main difference these are tasting so different is the drastic difference was between the 11 and the 14 vintage.
Yep.
They were two wildly different vintages, and we can get into that here in just 1 second.
Yeah.
But I will say, even if the vintages were quite similar, right? Even if we're looking at, let's say, 18 versus 19,
mm-hmm.
you're still going to have a significant or noticeable difference in the glass because you're dealing with two different bottle sizes. You know, the 750s will age faster than Magnums. So that's kind of a fun reason to have a Magnum. When you look at the alternative formats, a 375 split to a 750 to a Magnum, they age faster the smaller they are. So, you know, I love buying the same wine in alternative formats so I can see how the ageability process is being expressed across half bottle, full, and mag.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we did quite recently an episode about it. And,
oh, very
and,
cool.
Yeah. And we talked about the like, when does that kick in?
Sure.
Right? And it's definitely after a few years, right?
Absolutely.
So the differences between this 11 and 14, I would assume then, like you said, has a lot to do with the 14, 11 vintage.
The vintages, because those effects of the alternative sizes really should just be kicking in right about now, right? So we're at their infancy as far as noticing that is concerned. So really here, it's driven by the vintages.
Yeah.
So 11 is one of the coolest vintages that we've ever seen in California, which, as I understand, makes it wildly popular here in Norway.
Yeah.
Right?
And it is quite a Norwegian, more of a Norwegian style, right?
Of course. Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. Because you're dealing with, really across the state, some greener notes, a bit more like pyrazine present in the wine. And you're getting a lot more acid as well. Again, a cooler vintage. And Ridge, you know, obviously is no exception to that. So when you're talking about Lytton Springs, we had an uncharacteristically cool winter and a very long winter. So everything was kind of pushed back. Additionally, we had above average rainfall. So in the Dry Creek Valley area, we average about 25 inches of rain per year. We saw around 40 inches in the 2011 vintage. So it was really nice to kind of refill our well reserves that we have on property. You know, we are big on again, being stewards of the environment and recycling water, gray water is very important to us, which, again, we can discuss later. But that was an added bonus of the 11 vintage. And so you could see really the effects of that cooler climate year, even all through the summer when we didn't get any noticeable heat spikes. When you look at even the tech sheet of the 11 or the Lytton Springs, normally we are harvesting this wine between mid-August to mid-September. In the 2011 vintage, we were mid-September to mid-October. I mean, that's a pretty drastic difference when you're talking about one vineyard.
But still, Rich is delivering throughout the years much different between the vintage of the high qualities. So
yes.
You don't have a Montebello who's the same thing every year. It's around the weather all the time. So it's open. So you can have cooler vintages and you can have warmer and you can feel it.
Yeah.
And like this, I called an old friend when I talked, took the Magnum out, but I know I knew that they have it, so I love it.
Yeah, but that's a really interesting point that you make, and I'm really glad that you said that as well, because I think that's really speaks to the heart of the Ridge style, is a consistency of style, but always a reflection of what the vintage has given us.
Yes.
You know, so if you taste Lytton Springs, the 11 and the 14, these are both undoubtedly Lytton Springs, but they're not going to taste similar necessarily because 11 and 14 were not similar.
Yeah.
So what we want is consistent complexity, not consistent homogeny. And so with that, you know, at the heart of all of that is an assemblage process. And that is the same with the Lytton Springs, with the Kaiser, with the Montebello. But, you know, we have these blocks planted at Lytton Springs and Geyserville. They are tasted every year and assembled by our winemaking principals. And really that allows us to reflect what the vintage has been and give us a little bit of that fluctuation, if you will.
And I think you'll tell you that you will love rich when you have many in the cellar, because it's like 15 different children who is all in a different matter all the way.
They're all related to you, but they all have different personalities.
But in the same way, if you visit Rich, you will also see that everything is under control. So it's not making a uniform. And you can see that in the States today, that the money is getting bigger and the uniform is getting tighter. So it's just the same. And that's what I love about Rich. It's still, it's... And even if we have only four wines in the studio today, you will see that this autumn will be a fantastic for rich lovers in Norway, if they get it.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, and so, but we should need to move on to the rest, because we have now, you know, in the first wine with the Zinfandel, we had some Petit Sirah, and this is how much Petit Sirah? Because now we're moving on to the 2018 Lytton Springs, or is it Lytton Estate?
It's Lytton Estate.
Lytton Estate, my mistake,
so
sorry.
Estate, oh, that's okay. Lytton Estate is home. It's the larger estate that's home to Lytton Springs. So I will, if, if you're all right, though, if I could just talk about the 2014 vintage. Because I got a little bit carried away, my apologies. So while you have 2011, a very cool vintage with above average rainfall, 14 was a bit different. So 14 was in the middle of the first really designated drought that we've seen in the last 15 years or so. 12 through 15 vintages was that. And so with 14, you saw a much warmer year and far less rainfall, approximately 20 inches. So we're below average at that point. And I think that's why in the 14, aside from its youth, you're seeing some more punchy primary fruit aroma in this wine, whereas this is a bit more grounded, a bit more secondary, even a little tertiary at this point. Kind of fun.
Great.
Yeah.
Great. Okay. So now it's in the Petit Sirah. How much Petit Sirah is
in this? So
this
is 97% Petit Sirah and 3% Zinfandel. So, you know, Petit Sirah is a really fun varietal that we work with at Ridge. We've worked with it really since, I mean, throughout our history as a company in different respects. And so historically, we worked with it at the York Creek Vineyard in Spring Mountain. And that was regarded either as York Creek or Dynamite Hill. Dynamite Hill is within that York Creek estate. And we worked with that that site all the way through the 80s, 70s and 80s. And then, unfortunately, it was replanted to Cabernet Sauvignon. So we revived the Petit Sirah at the Lytton estate, because we have vines there, Petit, that were planted as early as 1901, 1903. And again, as more recently as the late 90s. So you get, again, a wide array of vine age with the Petit. And I would say this is probably one of the more under-recognized wines that we make. But it's really exciting because, you know, a lot of folks are familiar with Cabernet Sauvignon and the tannic structure that that can provide. But Petit Sirah is very, very tannic as well, equally as tannic in a lot of ways. But, you know, a bit different and can be just as elegant. And I think the more exciting thing is you can get a Petit Sirah at a more approachable price point rather than the quality that you're looking for a cab where you have to spend X amount of money.
After it's quite plummy, like on the nose especially. And perhaps it is of on the palate, it is quite tannic, but it's surprisingly light and it's surprisingly non-jammy compared to the more jammy nose. It's strange. Like, I don't drink much Petit Sirah.
No.
So it's interesting for me. I'm just talking
about it. But it's just it's the thing with Rich always, when you have younger vintages, decant it, have it breed, have it in good glasses. This is wine, so usually it's very good to have 10 years time in the cellar. But also, I know what you like. And this is also a typical food wine to barbecue or beef steak.
Absolutely. So,
but also what Rich could do with grapes who is not known to common. And you are open about it. Usually they hide it, the names of the grape. And this is, for me, this is a little bit young, but it's good. But I don't know what point I will give it. But I will have it in a glass for at least a half an hour, then we'll see. But it's good.
Yeah. In fact, I actually, I really encourage people to get a practical and sturdy decanter at home. It doesn't have to be pretty. Just has to aerate the wine. I actually decant all of my wines under 10 years old. I think they all benefit them in some way. And I'm not talking just Ridge as well. I'm talking other producers that I drink, you know, in my own personal time. But to your point about the transparency on our labels, I think, again, that's another very admirable thing and something that we champion at Ridge. So if you look at our labels, you get hit with just so much information. And that's our commitment to transparency. So on the front label, you'll get all of the pertinent information, right? You'll get varietal composition and inclusion, ABV, AVA. But on the back, you get a really great breakdown and insight into the Ridgeway as well. You'll get a vintage synopsis, just a quick recap into what the vintage was for us. And at the bottom, you'll see a full ingredients list. So anything that we used in the production of this wine, whether it be the grapes themselves, the oak from the barrel regiment, you know, minimum effective SO2, all of that is listed back here. The way that we look at it is there should be nothing to hide.
You know, it's strange because you're very transparent about it. It's on the label. But wine has been, and I think it's the same in Norway and in all around the world. I think Norway and the US are one of the ones who are trying to now encourage everyone that, like, legally you have to say everything that's in the food. And drinks. And wine has been the exception. And I have no idea why. But, like, you can buy a bottle in Norway, which is a wine monopoly, which has super strict rules, right? But you have no idea what you're buying. And I think there's very few, also very few blind tests, like, what do you call, like, scientific tests of what's actually in this. Like, we don't know if it has the amount of alcohol it's on the label. We don't have know how much the actually the SO2 is or all this other stuff. So it's interesting to see, you know, what's actually in the bottle, because no one reveals it. I haven't looked at it, but I think it's very interesting.
Yeah, and it's something that we, you know, we began in 2011 with the hope that more wineries would follow suit. And it has been a little disappointing to see the lack of participation. Because, again, wine is, in so many ways, a natural product. So why should there be this mystery, this cloudiness around what's in the bottle?
So we're talking about the Petit Sirah, and we're comparing it to the Cabernet Sauvignon, a little bit in style. But we're also looking at, again, two different vintages. So the 2018, how was the 2018?
It was wonderful. 2018 and 2019 were two stellar vintages out of California. Especially kind of, I don't want to say rebounding. 17 was more akin to the 2011 vintage as far as precipitation is concerned. 2017 was torrential. You know, almost a be careful what you wish for kind of thing. We came out of the drought vintages. 16, we got a little bit closer to our average rainfall. 17, it was double the amount of rainfall almost across the state. And while we were beyond excited to receive that amount of water, it almost took a lot of even the land by surprise. We were having erosion trouble at Montebello.
Because it's also so steep, right?
It is very steep. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is a mountain vineyard in every sense of the word. The topography can be
problem
very difficult.
It was a huge problems you have in Montebello.
Yeah.
We heard it on Twitter. So.
Oh, did you? You heard about the road washing.
I have alarm. So it was not a small one. It was a big –
It was a big chunk, So a big chunk of about a 10-foot stretch of road completely washed out. And we had to get in, and the city had to come in and rebuild it, just because there was so much water and rainfall that the mountain itself couldn't contain it. So we had just waterfalls coming down from every side of the mountain. It was really
That's the problem.
This is 17, right? You're talking about.
That's 17. So we got carried away in talking about that. And so while it was great to have that, it was almost a over course correction. So 18 brought that back to kind of more normal, more status quo, which we wanted to see. So we got pretty much our average rainfall across the state, and we got a more slow and methodical growing season from, you know, bloom and fruit set all the way through veraison and into harvest, which is fantastic. So when we're talking about the Zinfandels, we're talking, you know, beginning in second week of August, completing that in Sonoma, northern Sonoma by Healdsburg and Geyserville. Mid-September, and then for our Pagani Ranch, which is a Zinfandel that we work with out of Sonoma Valley, the beginning of October, right? We were really excited to see that. And then at the Montebello Mountain, what we see is we begin with Chardonnay, usually the first week of September, and then the Bordeaux varietals will be a bit slow and steady through the month of September and October, typically ending right around Halloween, maybe the first week of November.
It's a really long, harvesting season. Okay, so let's talk about the differences in these two wines, right?
Yeah.
Because you're saying 18, 19, both stellar vintages.
Great vintages.
So somewhat easier to compare. It's now it's both more about the style, the vineyards, and the grapes then.
Absolutely, yeah. So, you know, then really here you're talking about vineyard site. So the Petit Sirah, the Litton Estate, is up in, again, Sonoma, Dry Creek Valley, so about Healdsburg. The Montebello or the Estate Cab is going to be about a 2.5 hour drive south. So you're talking a pretty significant difference away, right? Now, what these two vineyard sites have in common is their proximity to the San Francisco Bay. So the San Francisco Bay is kind of considered the air conditioning unit for the state of California. The effects of the bay are so powerful they can be felt all the way into the Sierra Nevada mountains. So quite a distance away. And our proximity, the San Francisco Bay almost splits these two vineyards in half as far as distance is concerned. And so with the Estate Cab, one of the, you know, kind of ingredients to the style of this wine is the proximity to the bay and then also the Pacific Ocean. So to the Pacific, we're about 15 miles straight as the crow flies. But the Santa Cruz Mountains are two mountain ranges separated by the San Andreas Fault. So the western range actually kind of blocks us immediately from the Pacific, which is why we can more successfully grow the Bordeaux varietals, right? We need a little bit more warmth for the Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Cab Franc, Petit Verdot. And so the Estate Cab, I actually consider this to be one of, if not the best values on the wine market. And really that comes from the winemaking process at its heart. So we talked a little bit about Montebello. Unfortunately, we're not tasting it today.
No, we have. I have a very small bottle to you.
Oh, we do. Yeah, okay, fantastic. So we can
have it.
I have it, it for you.
On what do you mean a very small, like an airplane small bottle?
Oh, it's smaller than an airplane bottle.
This is a price afterwards. But we, I don't know if you have tasted it before, Jotun, but if you taste
I'm not sure, no.
Montebello is a kind of a god sometimes if you have tasted it. But it's always better when it's 20, 25. And also, I'm not going to have just only one for you, Jon Trygve. We're going to serve in 3-4 vintages sometime when we are traveling to California.
Sure.
Exactly.
So this is Montebello is something which just stands out for one of the best wines in the world.
Yeah.
But there's also so much different with the vintages. Just wow. And I got this small bottle for you, Jontrygve, just as a present.
Fantastic.
Yes. That's very
great.
Nice.
Yes.
I
just have a question for you,
just
on the side, because you're talking about the fog.
Yes.
Are you following the fog on Twitter?
Like the fog has its own Twitter account?
Yes.
No.
Yeah, it have. And we will find it and we'll give it to our... I follow it. I'm going to find it.
Are you the admin of the
No.
But
I have my own account. And when you see these fantastic pictures, they take pictures from the bridge and so on.
Oh.
And every day they are sending out how it is.
That's fantastic.
It's fantastic. So
Which is good because the fog really is its own character
in
the Bay Area.
But, you know, sometimes it's weird working with this fine because, you know, I can meet him in the morning and he's like, yeah, did you see the fog this morning? And I was like, what fog? And well, in California.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, sure, yeah.
You didn't know you're working with such an international man of weather.
Yeah, exactly.
And so it's interesting. So I bring up Montebello because, of course, that's the flagship, right? That is the wine that started us as a company. And it is, you know, regarded as one of the top wines in the world, which we're consistently really proud of and humbled by. But I love speaking about the Estate Cab in particular because there becomes this misconception in the market that the Estate Cab is kind of the Class B label to Montebello, right? That we put all of our top fruit into Montebello, which is why it has the price point that it does and the notoriety, and then all of the leftovers go into the Estate Cab. And that could not be farther from the truth. So what's really interesting about those two wines is they are made side by side every year for two distinct purposes, right? And so that all comes back to the uniqueness of the vineyard site. So it is, again, a mountain vineyard, as we spoke of earlier. We cover about 2,000 feet of elevation between the very bottom and the very top of the vineyard site. And we have, over those feet, we have about 40 blocks that are dedicated to either Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Cab Franc, or Petit Verdot. But again, because of the steepness of the vineyard site and the mountain topography, each block has a different sun exposure. And then we deal with the added kind of vintage by vintage specifications, like the inversion layer, right? Where it comes in, how long it sits in the day, where it sits on the mountain. So because of that, none of those 40 blocks are identified for Montebello or Estate Cab. Instead, what we do is we harvest them all every year, and we actually vinify them the same right off the bat. whole berry fermentation. We automatic sort about 15%, hand sort the rest. They're pressed after about 9 days. And then in February the following year, we begin a five-month blind assemblage process where our winemaking principals, Paul Draper, John Olney, our current head winemaker, his team, David Gates, our senior VP of vineyard management, they make three or four passes where they very purposefully put together two different types of Cabernet expression. The estate cab is naturally made to be more approachable in its youth, a little slightly less tannic, more drinkable and designed for 10 to 15 years. We mm-hmm. really want people to drink it within 10 years of aging. This is meant to open up this evening and enjoy with friends.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas the Montebello, to your point, is designed for decades of longevity. Hmm. But again, because of the uniqueness of the site and how different a vintage can be, it is not uncommon for a block to go into Montebello 1 year and estate cab the next. So you're getting our flagship fruit for about a third of the price with this bottle, which is really cool.
Yeah, and what was the reason why it would sometimes go in? Is it because they don't make the Montebello in each vintage, or because they don't use all of the fruit in each vintage?
No, so we make the Montebello every year.
Yeah.
Yep, and the estate cab every year. But for example, the inversion layer that we were talking about, right?
Yeah.
Now, historically, that sits kind of right on top of our bottom Chardonnay parcels, on top of what we call the Jim Samir Ranch, or also the Klein Vineyard that we spoke about earlier. Now, that inversion layer comes in really thick and heavy, and as you can imagine, kind of cools down those vineyard parcels, right? So mm-hmm. you get this really searing acidity, but maybe not quite the sugar development that you would see at the Cabernet at the top at our Peroni that's under pure California sunshine. So if we're trying to create, again, maintain this consistency of style, and we're not expecting that underdevelopment, we don't want to just blindly put it into Montebello because it's going to drastically throw off the characteristic and composition of that wine. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not a winemaker, but it makes sense as far as, you know.
Again, what we're looking for is that consistency of style, but not homogeny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I've tasted these two last wines up against each other, and obviously they're very different. But it was very, very fun to taste Cab Estate because that's the only wine in my notes that I didn't have the price for. So I was like, okay. I don't know, and I don't think I've tasted it before. Mm. So I was like, how's this wine going to be? And I think this is definitely the wine that I'm going to weigh it out for and try to grab a bottle when it gets up, because I think it's fantastic. And you say it's supposed to be approachable early.
Yes.
Now, I think it's fine to drink now.
Absolutely.
But if I buy a couple of bottles, I'm definitely going to hold out a couple of more years just to open it a bit more, because I think the potential is great. And I think we've had great wines here today, and it's obviously fun to also taste the 11, but to me the 19 really stands out. I don't know what the price is, but
the price is not known, but I think it will be around 11 to 1300 krona, something around.
Yeah. Okay. So a lot cheaper than Montebello, but and you know, not really cheap still, but I think I'm going to try to buy a couple of bottles anyway.
We have one buyer.
Yeah. Oh, Vita, exactly.
Fantastic. Okay, so worth coming to Norway, yeah.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. We've almost spent an hour.
Great.
So we've spent a lot of your time. And for those listening, I think, you know, we've been talking a lot. It's been really educational. For me, it's been really fun to taste range for the first time.
The fog.
I'm gonna have to follow the fog.
350,000 liters still.
Oh my goodness.
So it's
all right. Cool.
And for our listeners, as always, we put the links to the wines that are available. We'll put them in the show notes in the podcast. This time we're also going to put the link to the fog, the fog Twitter account, so everyone can follow it. That would be strange to have like hundreds or thousands of people in Norway starting to follow the fog in San Francisco.
I hope the fog sends you a sweatshirt or something.
Yeah, exactly.
But we are 17 from Norway who follow the fog.
Yeah. But Katie, thanks a lot for coming.
Yeah.
We really appreciate it. Thanks for tasting wines with us. Have a happy 60th anniversary for the rest of the year.
Thank you, guys. This has been so much fun. I appreciate the two of you. Cheers.
Cheers.
Yeah.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Ukens vindtips med Svein en Finansavisen podcast. Programleder Svein Lindin, produsent Lars Brenden Skram, og podcast- og videoansvarlig Marius Mørk Larsen. Ansvarlig redaktør Trygve Hegdar.